So, one of the things that we've done again today is to really go through this whole process of working with the sense of just, first of all, just being aware of the body, being aware of space around us, and working with the Kabbalistic cross, working with the middle pillar exercises, and then this process of descending into the deep, emerging first of all in the shape of the sanctuary of the living flame, and then exploring the this image of the scarabaeus and the spiral serpent, which takes us into, as Jess said, an experience of the renewal of the temple, and the temple not made by hands, meaning the temple created through will and imagination and presence. Now, part of the reason that makes it a powerful experience is because we have preambled that experience with the Kabbalistic cross, and in particular the middle pillar exercise. Because what we're doing is really engaging our body and our psyche with quite powerful energies that are designed really to kind of wake us up and kind of it's a powerful kind of alchemical process, the middle pillar in particular. I mean, the Kabbalistic cross is equally powerful. It brings a sense of verticality and horizontalness and centeredness. That's the function of the Kabbalistic cross, in a sense. It creates that sense of dynamic balance in the body. Now, having created that, then what we're doing is working with the different levels of our psyche, working with the sense of the central axis of the body, and connecting it up with the earth center, the spirit center, and then circulating life and energy through different aspects of our psyche. And we start off, of course, with the circulation front and back, then side to side, and then this very powerful alchemical process of working with the fountain. Now, as I said last time, I think these practices are taught to me by Ernest Butler and Tom. But historically, that you first see them breaking, I suppose, being consciously used in the way that we use them now. Middle to late 19th century. But they have their roots in a much earlier form of Kabbalah called the Iyun circle, which is IYYUN. The word ayun means contemplation, so it's the circle of contemplation, which is an 11th century Kabbalistic group working in Provence and North. Iyun means contemplation. Now, the Iyun circle produced so they were active in the 11th century in Provence and northern Spain, and they produced a series of documents called the text of contemplation, and the more important text is called the Fountain of Wisdom. And the kind of exercise, ultimately, I'll bring in this material at a later point in the course. But the Ayun practitioners were really working with the sense of working with flow, working with the creativity of the universe and the creativity of human beings. So what happens when we do these practices, and when we we create a sort of, if you like, a field of awake energy, I suppose we could say, which then, as we go into the kind of sense of descending into the deep, this, in a sense, travels with us. So it intensifies the experience. And in a way, if we think of this image of the scarab and the spiraling serpent, now the work of the circulation of the light is in a way is sort of linked to the spiraling serpent. Because the serpent is all about movement. The serpent is all about shedding skins and renewing things. So there's a certain way in which the practice of the middle pillar, the practice of the circulation of the light, creates this field around us, which we see in the image of the book of Gates, where we have the sense that the scarabaeus represents the heart center, the center of ourselves, and we have circulated the light around us and created a field of light and energy around us, which enables us to go into the deep, which enables us to descend into the duet. Now what happens to us when we descend into the duet is we descend into the deep, and then we, if you like, lose form and then enable other forms to arise. It's a sense of opening to a wider sense of self that then enables new forms to arise. Now what happened in this instance was we come back to the sanctuary, which is a place we will continue to come back to, because this represents that image, that symbolic image, represents us, our own sense of stability within the mysterious flow of things. So it's a starting point, it's an important starting point for us to orientate ourselves. Now what happens after that is we experience the image of the sort of scarab and the spiraling serpent takes us down into another experience, which is the experience of the ruined temple tomb that becomes renewed through our attention being paid to it. Now the idea of the temple not made by hands, and the idea of the renewing of the ruined temple, is a very ancient idea in many mystical traditions, and very much connected to the idea of contemplation. The word to contemplate is to enter the temple, to enter the sacred space. And in the word temple, like the word template, really suggests a shape, a form, which holds us and which enables life to arise within. The temple is a sort of, we could call it a womb space that generates life. Now, in Western tradition, one of the great temples that is certainly ruined, and that certain fundamentalists in Israel are trying to renew, is the Temple of Solomon. As Jess said, it completely relates to Masonry. The whole tradition of Freemasonry is about the rebuilding of Solomon's Temple. Lots of funny handshakes and weird little. When I used to work over the road at the bottom of Silver Street, because up above Labyrinth Books on the High Street, there is a Masonic temple, and I used to work on a Tuesday before, in the days before we lived here. So I would work, I'd come So Tuesday night is when the Masons used to meet there, and it's a very secluded place. So they used to come out for a fag, kind of in between, and it's quite an extraordinary thing, because they're all dressed in suits first of all, because it's a very formal kind of organisation, but they're suits with brightly coloured aprons and these amazing white or orange gloves that they wear. And then they got these medallions that they have as well. So it was sort of catching the Masons out, really. But even the phenomenon of Masonry is a kind of interesting thing, right? Because it's just a business organization these days, fraternal organization. But it's built the if you go to one of the grand Masonic lodges, it's got pillars, it's got a checkered floorboard, it's got a structure that ultimately derives from the archetypal shape of the Temple of Solomon, which in itself arises out of the Egyptian temples. Now there are, the Temple of Solomon has an outer court, an inner court, and a Holy of Holies. Now that structure comes right out of the Egyptian tradition, where you have the outer court that is open, you have the inner colonnaded court, and then you have the Holy of Holies, which is where the shrine of the, where the image of the god is found. In the Temple of Solomon, in the outer court, you have an altar of offerings and an altar of purification. You have an inner court where you find the menorah and the candlestick of seven candles, and then you have this inner place where the Holy of Holies, where you find the Ark of the Covenant, where the presence of the god is found. Now this is a completely Egyptian idea, taken up there, who knows how, but a very central thing that you find in the process of contemplation and the process of inner work is the idea of encountering a temple that is ruined, that needs to be restored. Which is what part of this meditation was about. You know, in the story of Paddy Aminope, he specifically says at the beginning of his tomb, "You who wander around, you who in later years wander around the necropolis for your pleasure and recreation." If you know the great God, make offering to the God that which has decayed may be renewed.
If you know
the great God, make offering to this God that which has decayed will be renewed. Now what you have in the tomb, temple of Paddy Aminope, is a tomb, but it's a tomb that is also a library that contains all the texts of spiritual texts of Egypt, right from the Old Kingdom, right up into Paddy Aminope's time, including the Book of Gates. And what he shows in that is the other thing that you find with temples, and you find it in abbeys, you find it in the ruined Abbey of Glastonbury, is that as well as being a sacred place, it also is a container for the lost knowledge. So you have these scriptoriums or libraries or places where which could be lost is held as in a time capsule, so that when it is needed, it's available again. So one of the things that can happen to us, really, when we're working within inner temples, is that as well as having experiences, as well as noticing different energies and different memories arising and things happening to us, we also experience being given knowledge that is a sort of living knowledge, that and it's not normally sometimes it can be very direct, and more often than not, it's a sort of a hint or an image that when we hang out with, expands and becomes known within us. So there's a certain way in which to contemplate whether it is to rebuild the temple. And then having rebuilt the temple, to operate within the temple, to work with it as a living form. And an important part of, if you like, of inner work is to, you know, and it's interesting, we have this outer inner kind of disjunction often. You know, which is interesting, Andy's experience of the bishops is part of this really, where the outer form of things becomes separated from the inner meaning of things. And this is one of the ways in which temples become polluted, profaned, they lose their inner meaning. I always think of Jerusalem when I think of this, because you know, I've spent a lot of my working life working in Jerusalem. And it's a city that's full of forms, full of religious forms. You know, you have every Christian denomination on earth represented in Jerusalem. You have very powerful Islamic traditions, very powerful, of course, Jewish traditions also, all side by side in a small city. And and the problem with most of these forms is that people use them to fight with. And classically, the place where the Temple of Solomon was, which was, you know, final temple, was destroyed by the Romans. In fact, if you're in Jerusalem, there's a bit around the city walls where you can still see the stones of the temple, where they were just chucked over the edge of the walls, and just a big pile there. And of course, what is there now is extremely beautiful Dome of the Rock, which is another temple. It's a beautiful sacred space. The Dome of the Rock is there. So where the
space for the temple.
Yeah, space where the temple was, right on Temple Mount. What there are two great buildings: the Dome of the Rock, and then the Alaska Mosque. And the Dome of the Rock, and because the Dome of the Rock is also because the Temple Mount is an interesting place, because it's originally David buys it, King David buys it, and what he buys is it's interesting in terms of bread imagery, because what he buys is a threshing floor. So the temple itself, the whole of the Temple Mount, is based on a threshing floor that is used to thresh grain. And I don't know whether that's literally true or not. This image of bread and beer that we have coming up in the Book of Gates is central to the inner tradition of Egypt. And the experience, we're going to hear quite a lot about bread and beer and the making of bread and beer, because that image is used as a way of understanding the inner process of becoming your true self. Now the threshing floor, which also has the sort of grinding stone just next to it, are two important processes that are early processes about the alchemical work, Because what threshing does, first of all, is to this process of, which really what you know what they used to do is you'd have a bull or something or a cow that would go round and round in a circle, stepping on the grain, sort of, and breaking down the kind of the husk from the berry inside it. Well, that as well, yeah, but. Well, the millstone is the next step, which is the grinding step. But the first thing with the threshing floor is it's walked round and round and round, so the husk gets broken off from it, and then it is winnowed. Now, in the end of the first hour of the Book of Gates, we have this idea of raw winnowing. So this idea of the separation of the chaff, which is the husk, which is the stuff that's not needed, that covers over. So this sense of breaking down the, if you like, the things that cover over the light or cover over the energy of life, the nutritious creative bit. So that's the first step that happens in the alchemical process. The next thing that happens is the grinding. So there are these processes, very powerful kind of processes, really, that are about that actually are right at the heart of the tradition of kind of becoming your true self, that are linked to these processes of creating bread. Now, with the it's very important in the winnowing process that the chaff is blown off and is separated. So the whole in alchemical idea, they talk about the idea of separatio, separation, where you separate things so they're not mixed together. The grinding process is like they call it calcination. So with grinding, if you grind something, you've got to make sure the stone doesn't get too hot. Because if it gets too hot, it starts to burn the flour and make it not fit to be eaten. So there's a whole process of cooling the stone and keeping things kind of moderate. So right at the heart, so this is where the temple arises from. Right, so the temple actually arises from this process, this threshing floor that the temple is built on top of. In the same way, in Egyptian temples, the idea that you enter into the presence of Osiris, who is the barley god, who is the grain god. In a similar way, there is not exactly identical, but in a similar way, you have these processes that are around the brewing of beer, the making of bread. And that the temple, the point of the temple, is to create a shape within which that can happen.
Does that relate to the dismembering that's in the?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Because the dismembering is part of the separation process. It's breaking down. Because the word in the thing is selection stroke dismembering. So there is a breaking down and a selection of that which is needed, and a rejection of that which is not needed.
And is that linked in some way to the dismemberment of Osiris?
Yes, I mean that's in the Egyptian tradition. That's right. The whole, you know, the whole myth of Osiris, which I'll talk a bit about this afternoon, is really about the breaking apart of Osiris, this split, and then the coming back together in a new form.
Well, literally, like taking out his organs. Is that sort of the meaning for dismembering?
Yeah, that's right. Breaking apart of this, literally taking apart, right? So in order to come back in, you know, to come back together in a new way.
And Osiris was created from the wheat and Set.
Well, kind of. The originally, if we go right back into Egyptian tradition, we can go back before Osiris, we can go back into the creator god Ra. So the great goddess Neit, who is the weaver goddess, who creates the gods. She creates she creates Ra from wheat, and Apophis, who is the great enemy and opponent of Ra, is created from the bit that's left over, the husk that's left over. So Apophis is the represents that energy of resistance, that energy of challenge, that energy of that stops things from happening and it stops creation happening and bringing it back into chaos. Right, that's the kind of the energy of Apophis. Now in the tradition, Apophis is important. He's not killed, he's restrained and contained, but is somewhere necessary for the whole process to happen. Nissen and Evanissen. That's right. So Evanissen, who is the energy of killing and destruction, is as necessary as Nissen. And this is this thing you have in Egyptian tradition of opposites working together. Right, so it's shadow and light, it's sort of goodness, badness, and it's how to hold those opposites together. And the temple is one of the places where those opposites are held together. Hence, in the temple, that's represented by the image of the two pillars. The two pillars needing to work together.
And the black and white.
The black and white checkerboard pavement, exactly. That's where that comes from, right?
Literally, there was a black and white checker in the Temple of Solomon.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
And then the Eleusinian mysteries, the actual point of the whole thing, which was a kind of Bali type cult, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was the showing of the living wheat.
Yes, that's right.
Chaff and.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, yeah.
Relate to
Apophis? Kind of. Set is a more individuated. So Set is for Osiris is the adversary. Mm. But Set is a similar kind of figure, but Set is also the defender of Ra. In the boat of Ra, in the Amdu, Book of the Amduat, it is Set protects Ra against Apophis. So it's another way of saying that energy, that destructive, killing energy of the Red Desert, needs to be overcome and is also necessary.
So, sorry, maybe I'm being a bit literal here.
Sorry.
Is this all sort of allegorical, like Buddha and Mara?
Yeah.
You're fighting a process, or is this something much more universal, like these forces exist?
Both, really. All right. So of course it is true that you're fighting, you're working with your process. But the Egyptians would say there are these energies in creation. There are these, which they are interpreting in their way of understanding the form, right? And so, one of the things we're going to look at is how these are. So that basically they would say that there's an energy of creation and an energy of destruction, and learning to and that you personify in different ways. So it's personified in one way in Egyptian tradition, and Hebrew tradition would give it another name. Christian tradition would give it another name, And one of the things we're going to do in this course is really to look at how these fundamental energies get interpreted culturally in different ways, right? But at the bottom, we're looking at energies that are that kind of push and pull energies, right?
It's duality.
Yeah. It's working with duality. So in a way, and working with this whole idea that Jung has about working with opposites to enable the third thing to arise. And so that's absolutely central in this. Let's just stop now and go and have our lunch. And